I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers have been debating financial reform all this week, including reining in the derivatives market, which was at the heart of the financial collapse. We want to hear how reform is going, but first, we want to spend some time today with author Michael Lewis. Now, Michael first stumbled onto a job on Wall Street in 1985 and wrote the book Liar's Poker about what he thought then would be a great reckoning for the street's bad practices. Well, it finally came in the recent collapse. We're by now familiar with the real estate derivative market collapse. Thousands of mortgages were sold, largely to people unable to pay them back, then resold to Wall Street, which bundled and sold the loans as bonds. They were ticking time bombs, set to explode when homeowners defaulted. But initially, Wall Street was completely unaware. How could that be? That's one question posed in Michael's terrific book, The Big Short. Now, a short is a bet against a bond or a derivative. It's like taking out insurance. You're paid when the bond fails, as you guessed it would. But as Michael writes, a short against these mortgage bonds was like taking out insurance on an already burning building. That's how obvious it was that the mortgage bonds would fail. But only a few people figured that out. Who were they? Well, a one-eyed doctor with Asperger's syndrome, for one. And then there was Steve Eisman, the staunch Republican conservative turned Wall Street socialist, once he realized how, as he says, stupid and Machiavellian the market was. We want to learn about these men, but also what Michael Lewis thinks about reform. By the way, send your questions to letters@hereandnow.org, or you can go right to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us and send an email or leave a comment. We're going to get to those as well. But Michael Lewis, welcome back to Here and Now.
Oh, well, thanks, Robin. You're doing such a good job summarizing my book. I feel like you don't really need me.
Goodbye.
But happy to be here.
Well, we got a taste of all of this when you first visited us back in December of 2008. You'd written an article about this. Now you've got this terrific book. Let's talk about some of these characters. It's phantasmagoric, but start with Steve Eisman. You write a curious character who walked onto Wall Street at the very beginning of this new curious time, these mortgage bonds. Who was he?
Well, let me back away for just one second, because you have to frame Steve Eisman.
Please.
To appreciate how interesting he is. That you have the entire financial system having organized itself around this bet, and 99% of the system is betting on subprime mortgages, and you have literally a dozen, 15 investors in the whole world who make go all in betting against this, and Eisman's one of them. Mm-hmm. And the question always is, you know, why is it that these handful of people were able to see what nobody else was able to see? And in each case, it's a little different. There were different paths to the right answer. And in Eisman's case, he was one of the two original analysts on Wall Street with a big Wall Street firm of subprime mortgage originators, the people who actually lend money to people to buy homes when maybe they shouldn't be doing it. And this business was really born in the mid-90s. And Eisman came of age on Wall Street watching this interaction between high finance and lower middle class America, and saw how poisoned the relationship was.
Well, I'm just going to jump in to say one thing, you know, for people, especially who haven't read the book or don't remember, I just want to remind them, as you do, remind us, that this was so new. These bonds that we're talking about, they used to be these single giant loans, like you'd invest in your city or a corporation. These mortgage bonds were pools of thousands of these home mortgages. And as you said, they started to be sold to people who absolutely had no hope of ever paying them back.
Well, the loans were made to increasingly dicey borrowers, and they were made. Well, what Eisman observed in the 90s was the deceit that was often practiced upon the borrowers to get them to take out loans they really should not take out.
Well, and one of the ways he knew this is, for instance, his nanny called him at one point and said, "I own five homes in Queens," or something like this.
That's right, yeah. And Eisman, in addition to actually having a felt kind of on the ground understanding of how poisonous this relationship was between the borrower and the lender, he had a knack for saying, essentially speaking truth to power. I mean, as his wife said, my husband's rude. I know he's rude. I've tried, and there's nothing I can do about it. And he's a sort of character who, when he would be called out to a meeting with the head of a big Wall Street firm, all of his colleagues would insist on going just to watch the car crash.
Well, because he threw the F word around. I mean, he said what he
felt.
He
threw the F word around, right. But he offended whenever he was in the room with an important Wall Street person, he managed to say something to offend him. And mainly the gist of a lot of what he was saying was, your business is insane. You're going to blow up the world with this doomsday machine you're building called the subprime lending machine.
But
no one wanted to listen to him.
No one listened to him, and he had no way to do what on Wall Street is traditionally a way of sort of keeping the market on the straight and even by betting against them. He had no way to do that. That instrument didn't really exist yet. So put Steve Weissman aside, for you will, if a moment, because now enter Mike Burry to your stage. This is the one-eyed former doctor. He has a glass eye. He's a loner. He discovers that he has Asperger's. But these things kind of make him almost a whiz at investing. Tell us more about him.
Well, he has Asperger's and doesn't know he has Asperger's. Right. He's this wonderful character who's able to diagnose everything well but himself. And he had a hedge fund where he was running $500 or $600 million in San Jose, California. And he, you know, like Eisman, he didn't think of himself as someone who should be mucking around in subprime mortgage bonds. He was principally a stock market investor. His job was to find undervalued companies like Warren Buffett does. And he was given money by people because they thought he was a wizard at this. But he discovers 2003, 2004, the more he looks at financial companies and real estate companies, the more he sees their fate is dependent on these loans that are being made in increasing volumes called subprime mortgage loans. And he starts to dig into the loans. And as he says, if he didn't have Asperger's syndrome, he never would have discovered what he discovered, because he was phobic about social interaction. He had virtually no face-to-face interaction with Wall Street people. He lived his life on email, and he lived his investment life through data. He didn't listen to pitches. He didn't listen to the propaganda. He was just looking at numbers.
And Michael Lewis, is he really, just to, before you tell us what he saw, is he really, I mean, it seems impossible. Is he really the only one, except the lawyers who drafted them, the only one to actually read all the prospectuses? Is that
As he said, only someone with Asperger's syndrome would read a subprime mortgage bond prospectus. Mm-hmm. He was under the impression that nobody else knew what he knew about what was in these bonds, what was underpinning these bonds, how bad. I mean, the point was that the kind of loans that were being made was changing very rapidly. They went from being, 30-year fixed-rate loans where the borrower knew what he was on the hook for, to then floating-rate loans, where the borrower only had to repay interest and no principal, till finally floating-rate loans with teaser rates where the borrower, if he didn't make his interest payment, the interest payment just got rolled into a higher principal balance. So the loans could not get worse in their structure.
Right, so,
and he was able to see this before other people because he was looking at the loans.
So Mike Burry is the one who convinces someone at a bank to create these credit default swaps. I'm kind of move forward through the story here. And this is the way that he could bet against these. You buy one of these credit default swaps, and literally it's like buying this insurance that you talked about, betting that these will fail.
Slightly more complicated than you just said, but this is how it worked. Wall Street had been trading these things called credit default swaps, which is insurance. You're buying insurance on a bond. They've been trading them on other kinds of bonds, like corporate bonds or government bonds, for some years. What Mike Burry realized was they were going to invent them for subprime mortgage bonds so they could bet against the subprime mortgage bonds, so you could buy insurance on these things that were going to blow up. And he pushed them to do it as they were already thinking of doing it. And he was the first investor to get sold some of these things by Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs. They're the first ones to do business with him.
And he's incredulous, because he also figures out if he could cherry pick the very worst mortgages in these pools, hidden in there, and ask Goldman Sachs for lists of these worst mortgages, he could really make out, and they send it to him.
Yes, well, he's given these menus, and they're making very little distinction between what he knows are the worst pools of mortgages and the best ones. So he's known, because he's done his research, he knows that, say, for example, the loans made by Wells Fargo tend to be a lot better than the loans made by, say, Long Beach Mortgage Company. But the prices, the insurance price on is roughly the same on the two. And it makes no sense. And that tells him, to get back to the original point, that nobody's really doing the homework.
Right.
And this is the incredible point to me, that at this point, and now we're in the middle of 2005, but for and fully for another year and a half, maybe 2 years, the only people who are doing the sort of analysis or credit analysis one would normally do before making a loan on these loans are the people who are doing it to bet against them. Not the nobody else in the chain is doing this sort of analysis.
And these are just a handful. And by the way, one of the reasons that nobody else is doing any analysis and really the blinders on is because Alan Greenspan is saying home prices will never fall. There's no bubble here. It's never going to burst. But, of course, Steve Eisman, who we talked about, and Mike Burry don't believe this. They're clear-eyed. There's also now a Goldman Sachs trader, Greg Lipman, who also seems to get it. He begins to feverishly sell these swaps, including to Steve Eisman, the guy who knew that these bonds were going to fail but couldn't find an instrument.
Greg Lipman is actually a Deutsche Bank trader.
A Deutsche Bank, sorry. Yep, right. So he's doing that. Now, Mike Burry's wondering, why would Deutsche Bank and Greg Lipman want to sell me bets against their own, bonds, and then he figures out that it's AIG, the big insurance giant, that's now that is actually selling the insurance, and Deutsche Bank is acting as a middleman. And now, again, I'm moving the story forward. Steve Eisman and Mike Burry begin to realize separately, they don't even know each other, begin to realize that these bets that they're making, these credit default swaps that they're buying, are actually also being bundled and sold.
Yeah, this is mind-bending. And it really, you have to sit down and just think about this. But when Michael Burry buys an insurance policy, a credit default swap from, say, Goldman Sachs, the premium he pays mimics the interest payments that the subprime mortgage pools are generating. And so he's in effect, the way to think about it, when he buys insurance on a pool of subprime mortgage loans, he's replicating exactly those loans. Those loans go bad, he gets paid. And so he's doubling the risk associated with those loans. And yes, what Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank and Merrill Lynch and all the rest are doing are taking these credit default swaps that Michael Burry is buying, and they're bundling them up into what they're calling synthetic collateralized debt obligations, all of which will go bad because they're filled with insurance policies on loans that are going to blow up. So this is the one of the causes of the panic in 2008 that occurs is that they're all these – they're essentially zero-sum bets. Someone is on one side of the insurance policy. Someone's on the other. But nobody knows how much of this stuff is out there or who's got it. All they know when they realize that it's going wrong is that the bets were structured basically by the people who were betting against the loans, not by the people who were betting on them.
That's Michael Lewis. His book is The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. So we'll leave it at this point in the story, take a minute break. We have Steve Eisman, Mike Burry, a handful of others, including two guys from California who started out in their garage, we haven't had a chance to talk about, who have bought up all these credit default swaps. But what happens in the collapse? If they hold insurance, but the insurance is issued by companies that are about to fold, like AIG, will their bet come due? We will find out and also ask Michael what he thinks about reform. Michael Lewis, you stay right there, okay? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Michael Lewis. His terrific book is The Big Short. And we've been talking about the people who had that short, who bet against these mortgage-backed bonds. They were holding all of these credit default swaps, which were pretty much insurance policies, saying that these bonds were going to fail. But Michael Lewis, at this point in the story, everything is failing. Everything's falling apart. What did happen for Steve Eisman, Mike Burry, the first ones to realize that this was pretty much a Ponzi scheme, a scam, and they're holding all these credit default swaps? Did it pay off for them?
it paid off financially. They all got rich. But the thing that's so curious about this story to me is that it was how traumatized they all were by this experience, because they were not – none of these people were put on Earth to make this bet. They were all put on Earth to invest in the stock market, and the financial world kind of twisted them into this position. The only smart thing to do with their money was to bet against subprime mortgage bonds. And Eisman put it well, I think. He said, look, the moment it all starts to fall apart – he says, I knew how Noah felt then. You know, it's very nice that I have my ark when the flood comes. But as you're watching the civilization being swept away, it's not a happy moment for Noah. And so what happens to them? Michael Burry has such fractious relations with his investors because they're so upset with this bet he's made that even though he doubles their money, they all end up hating each other, and he drops out of the investment business altogether.
Yeah, because early on they're thinking, why are we betting against this? Everybody's buying these mortgage things. Why
aren't
you?
That's right. They were all hearing the same music that he was not listening to. And so his investors turned against him, and he turned against his investors, and he turned against the process of investing other people's money. Steve Eisman is still alive and well and doing very well running his hedge fund. But, you know, there's a wistfulness about him because I think he knows that the most interesting thing that will ever happen to him in his investment life just happened. We haven't spoken about the young men at Cornwall Capital who start with $100,000 in the Schwab account and end up with $120 million.
Right.
But they have, I think, partly gone their separate ways. I mean, for none of these people, this is another strange thing about them. For none of these people, they weren't money people exactly. Even though they all got rich, they were all people whose interests were almost all of them were more intellectual types than they were grasping, greedy money people. And so the fact they got rich was nice to all of them, but it doesn't define them. And the Cornwall guys are kind of off thinking about what they want to do with the rest of their lives, and maybe it's not managing money.
Well, Michael Lewis, I want to ask you some of the questions that come out of this. First of all, there's the chicken and egg question, because the debate has been raised again. You know, what happened during the crisis? Republicans like John McCain saying what happened is that companies, the government-backed companies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were forcing lenders to lend to people who couldn't pay off these loans. In reading your book, though, I don't see anybody whose arm is twisted. They were selling these loans predatorily in order to turn around and resell them to Wall Street.
Oh my God! The appetite of the private capital markets for these loans was so great that they had to synthesize them. They had to invent. Subprime mortgage loans because they ran out of crappy borrowers to lend money to. This was not an event that was generated by government activity. I mean, if you really want to point your finger at what the government did badly, it was more sins of omission than commission. It was not regulating the credit default swaps market, for example. But the share, for example, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Yes, they did buy subprime mortgage bonds, but their share of the market in 2005, 2006, 2007, as this machine gets roaring, actually shrinks because the private markets have such demand for this stuff.
And by the way, there was thinking early on that, gee, why not let the average person have another way to get equity instead of just using your credit card, which has such huge interest, 18%? Use your house. Refinance your house for 8% and get some credit. But that quickly was taken over by, as you write, the sleazy factor. I just want to get a couple of questions in from listeners. Rosalind Kaufman of Radnor, Pennsylvania, wants to know from you, Michael Lewis, what do you want to see in a second round of legislation, presuming that you agree that the proposed financial reforms only begin to scratch the surface? And other listeners ask, should we go back to not being able to trade people's mortgages?
No, but I think, I mean, to answer the second, the specific question about mortgages, I think that along the chain of mortgage bond creation, so the people who lend the money to the subprime borrowers, they need to keep skin in the game. They shouldn't be able to just sell the loans off. They have to bear some of the risk if the loans go bad. So they have incentive to make good loans. That wasn't true during the subprime lending spree. They would just sell the loans off, and so they were just being paid on volume. More generally, I think. That these big firms need to be broken up.
Well, that's what Yuichi Haraguchi of Menlo Park, California writes. Should the big banks be broken up?
I think they, one, need to be broken up, and I think they need to be broken up along very specific lines. I think that it's insane that they are allowed to bet their own money. In fact, it's one of their biggest businesses, is proprietary trading, is bet, but make bets on stocks and bonds at the same time they're investing, they're advising their customers what to do in those stocks and bonds. I think that that conflict of interest has always been pernicious, but in this latest round, this latest debacle, it was central to what happened.
I'm just going to say one last quick question, because we only have a minute. And, you know, we are so compelled by the figure of Michael Burry. Again, he was a doctor. He became a trader. He sat alone in his office. He was the one who saw this early on. And we just have a few seconds. You say he quit. He was so disillusioned. Have you heard from him? Does he feel at least he got some credit through your book? Because he wasn't even getting credit for being the guy who saw it.
I had lunch with him last week, and he thanked me. Yes, and he's hoping Brad Pitt's going to play him in the movie.
We do smell movie. Michael Lewis, his book is The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. Just a terrific read. Michael, thank you so much as always.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. When we come back, we'll have, of course, the latest news for you. Then we're going to take a look at that terrible story. Why are children being attacked in China? Back in a minute, here and now. President Obama today had harsh words for oil executives.
I have to say, though, I did not appreciate what I considered to be a ridiculous spectacle during the congressional hearings into this matter. You had executives of BP and Transocean and Halliburton falling over each other to point the finger of blame at somebody else. The American people could not have been impressed with that display, and I certainly wasn't.
The president also ordered a top-to-bottom review of the Minerals Management Service. That's the agency that oversees offshore drilling. This is the New York Times and others report that the MMS heard warnings about BP's drilling, but still gave BP a waiver on an environmental review and a go-ahead for the project in the Gulf. And since the spill in the Gulf, the MMS has granted more than two dozen more environmental review waivers. Meanwhile, NPR is reporting that the amount of oil spilling into the Gulf is at least 10 times the amount of official estimates. Well, we want to take a look at another controversial offshore drilling project that's slated to start this summer. Shell Oil is lobbying Washington to be able to push forward with plans to begin drilling off the coast of Alaska. The company purchased leases in 2008 and has preliminary approval to build exploratory wells in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas in the Arctic Ocean. But now President Obama has placed a moratorium on all new offshore drilling projects, and the Interior Department has given Shell until May 18th to provide more information. Erica Bolstad is a reporter from McClatchy. She joins us from Washington. Erica, Shell says they're moving forward. What case are they making?
Well, they are making a pretty strong case, in their opinion, that they have a detailed set of responses and safety plans that will help them in the event that there is either a blowout or some sort of spill or some sort of accident. And they're saying that their plan is complete and that they have plenty of experience in drilling in deep water and in shallow water and in Arctic waters.
In fact, they're saying that what their plan is to drill in 200 or fewer feet of water, as opposed to BP's 5,000-foot deep Gulf of Mexico dig.
Right, and there are a number of really big differences between deep water drilling and the kind of drilling that Shell is talking about. That said, there are huge differences in the conditions in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Arctic Ocean. In the Arctic, you're talking about the kind of weather conditions that most people never experience. It's frozen over. It's incredibly difficult to get to the Arctic anywhere near where they're drilling with, you know, the kind of flotilla of response vessels that BP has had from the fishermen and the community in the Gulf of Mexico. There's just no way to have the same kind of response if there is an accident. There's also very little good research about how to handle spills in the Arctic Ocean.
Well, so Shell is making the case that they're prepared for disaster, but as you say, critics are saying it's something that's even harder to do in the Arctic than in the Gulf. But the BP disaster has also exposed the poor regulation of offshore drilling. The Minerals Management Service, before the BP drilling, expressed doubts about some of the equipment. BP fluffed it off, and that was exactly the equipment that's thought to have failed. So given that, won't Shell have to wait until President Obama's proposal to split that agency in two, the way it is in Britain, and bolster the regulatory part.
It doesn't look like they're going to have to wait for the agency to be split in two, but they are a little bit in limbo right now. They have had to submit, you know, additional information about what kind of safety plan they have and what kind of response plan they have, and that is all in light of what happened in the Gulf. But right now, they're at a stage where they're waiting just the very final approvals to go ahead with their exploratory drilling, and so they're pretty close to actually drilling into the ocean floor.
Now, how do people in Alaska feel about this debate?
People in Alaska are pretty divided. You know, there's the history of the Exxon Valdez in Alaska, which makes people very cautious about trusting completely in oil companies. At the same time, many people in Alaska depend on oil companies for a paycheck. The third leg of this is that there are a number of Native people who live in the northern part of Alaska who are very concerned about the prospects of offshore drilling because these are people who depend on the marine mammals and whales and who kill and eat these animals as a way of life and of sustenance, and they're really concerned about what would happen if there is some sort of catastrophe.
Erica Bolstad with McClatchy Newspapers. Erica, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, a quick break when we come back to China, here and now. The Chinese are struggling to come to grips with a series of gruesome attacks on school children in their classrooms. On Wednesday, 7 kindergarten students and a teacher were stabbed and killed. Since March, there have been 6 of these school assaults in China, the attackers using knives and hammers, killing at least 17 people, most of them children. Dozens have been injured. Today, Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao told a Hong Kong TV station that the attacks demonstrate social tensions in China, tensions that have to be dealt with. The BBC's Damian Grammaticus joins us from Beijing. And Damian, first of all, to that comment, how significant is it that the Chinese Prime Minister speaks on television about this or actually any topic?
It's fairly rare that leaders do come out and address much in sort of a way like this, which is just on a TV station. I mean, often it'll be a formal speech, a set-piece speech, when they choose to be seen to be somewhere and tackling something. But I think what's also interesting about this, actually, to be honest, is that it's 2 months since the first attacks. And as far as I'm aware, this is the first time that a senior government figure has spoken fairly directly about them, other than to order increased security. So in some ways you could say it's taken a very long time for the Chinese leadership to come out and express, as Premier Wen Jiabao did today, that he felt distraught, and then to move on and talk about the need to address this issue.
Well, he also said China is making serious efforts in tackling social tensions, settling disputes, and improving local government's abilities to smooth things out. Start with the social tensions. What does he mean?
Well, I think that's what's sort of the big question underlying all of this. One possible reason that has been advanced for it, and I have to say we simply don't know because all these attacks are slightly different, but the reason being advanced is this is a symptom of a society under real strain, under real pressure, as it's transforming, as China is developing and becoming richer. That is putting real strains on society. Some are getting richer and more wealthy, but many, many are not. Many, many are struggling in the new sort of capitalist China. They may well encounter corruption at local levels. They may well find that local services in many ways are inadequate, whether that's schooling or education or health services or other forms of government services. They don't find they have any redress if they try and go to the courts, because those are controlled by the Communist Party. There's a real sense, I think, that people don't have safety valves and that pressures are building up, and this may be a manifestation of that.
But still, you know, yes, it's understood that people in China have far less recourse than people in, for instance, the U.S. against bureaucracies. I mean, people get hot under the collar here, but still, why not attack those bureaucrats? Why attack children?
These have been people who, these 6 attacks, who have had a variety of different issues. The first one, 8 children stabbed to death. That was a doctor who had split up from his fiancée and appears to have been enraged by that split. Another one was a teacher who had some sort of psychological problems, had been laid off 4 years ago, attacked a different school. Another one was a man who was a sort of petty businessman, if you like, had a little shop, and was in financial trouble. And this latest one was a local man in a small village in a rural area who owned the building the school was in, and he had a financial dispute with the lady who ran the school. It was a tiny place, 20 pupils. He apparently was wanting the school back and the lease was up, but she wanted to stay a couple more months until the end of term. So his was a sort of financial dispute. Now, why target the children and not officials? Well, perhaps because in Chinese society, if you really want to commit the most sort of shocking act that you can and lash out at society, children in China are incredibly highly valued and the center of their families, because remember, we have the one child policy. Most families here have just one child under the rules. So if you target children, it's incredibly shocking in China and breaks a real taboo.
Well, and even more so because China's recently lost so many children, 5,000 in that 2008 earthquake. But you know, it just brings to mind, when you talk about the economic stresses, we know that when economic stresses are ratcheted up, so are mental health issues. And The Lancet, the British medical journal, found that less than 10% of the 173 million Chinese adults believed to suffer from mental illness had ever received professional help. Only 10% of 173 million Chinese adults, 173 million needing help. Is there thinking that, yes, there sounds like there's anger, rage, stress. Is there also mental illness that's going undocumented, undetected?
Well, there undoubtedly is, yes, because many, many times in China you'll find that mental illness simply either isn't recognized as a problem, or families and individuals don't want to admit to it as a problem because it is a real stigma attached to it. The problem with that, I think, is linking it to these cases where it seems very few of them. Is there any indication at all of any mental illness? Look at the case this week. The gentleman who carried it out, a 48-year-old, as I was saying, he's the man who owned the school building, but his neighbours have been saying that he was a gentle, kind soul. He was a man with his own family, with two children. One of those children was a handicapped boy who he had taken in and given a home to, and he simply seemed to have flipped, and he walked into the school on Wednesday morning with a meat cleaver, killed the woman who ran the school, and then lashed out at every one of the 20 children in there, aged 3 to 6, killing 7 of them, and apparently was heard to say as he marched out, "They owed me rent." Some in China are saying you shouldn't jump to conclusions, because to blame these attacks on people who are mentally ill without evidence simply would stigmatize the mentally ill even further here.
Well, meanwhile, your colleague Michael Bristow reported earlier this week that the news reports about Wednesday's attack are minimal. Are there fears now of copycats? Maybe this was a copycat, but are there fears of even more?
Yes, absolutely. Of course there are. There are parents who are deeply worried here now in China. And the other response, though, has been a security response. So you've had a clampdown on reporting and a ramp up of security. Now at schools, you'll find armed guards, guards with batons, with pepper spray. Guards even have been issued in some schools these strange pitchfork type implements with which they're meant to pin an attacker armed with a knife up against the wall so he can be tackled. But in many ways, those are sort of traditional Communist Party responses to a serious issue like this. Limit reporting, increased security. It doesn't seem to address the fundamental issues, and also doesn't address the question that many people are saying, well, you should report this because we should debate the issues about why this is happening, and parents should be aware so that they can make their own arrangements to protect their children if they wish.
That's the BBC's Damian Grammaticus from Beijing reporting on the increase in attacks on children in China. Damian, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. We now know more about one of the most popular videos on YouTube. You may have seen it. It's been viewed more than 4 million times. But if, like us, you can't get enough, we'll have it at our website, hereandnow.org. I'm referring, of course, to the 82nd Airborne Division's 4th Brigade Combat Team in Afghanistan in the most fun karaoke since Tom Cruise slid across the living room in his boxer shorts. These soldiers acting out the Lady Gaga video, Telephone. We see muscle-bound guys in camo waving their arms, hips gyrating. Are they flirting? Has anyone called the Don't Ask, Don't Tell police? It's the brainchild of Sergeant Aaron Melcher, also the inspiration behind the new Facebook fan club page, Aaron Melcher is the Hotness. A fan writes, he's straight and married, but he's got two moms. How cool is that? It's the reason he's so comfortable having fun. Well, Aaron's wife, Michelle, told the Fayetteville Observer that her husband has been working on the video for weeks. The men were practicing after work, a lot of effort, especially on the Beyoncé solo. Here we see a soldier dressed in a skirt that looks like it's made out of a plastic garbage bag with yellow electrical tape, an homage to Lady Gaga's sartorial savvy. The troops spokeswoman Michelle Baldanza told MTV the soldiers have a challenging mission there and they were just having a good time and blowing off some steam in their downtime. When asked by CBS News what his superiors thought, Aaron said, "Everyone over here pretty much thinks it's the most hilarious thing they've ever seen. And since there's not much hilarity in war, we're glad for them." Well, music and U.S. troops are central to our last story today.
It's been out on the countryside, them tailgates down, the fire's burning bright, and though it's 80 degrees with humidity, it makes the same twice as hot.
Kenneth Flay never spent a day in jail. He was out chilling with Tom DeLay on bail. Meanwhile, the war's spiraling out of control, and your sons are sitting duck while he's on a patrol.
It's a slide.
This music is part of the campaign Songs for Soldiers. The goal is to send an MP3 player to each of the 185,000 American troops stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq. Songs for Soldiers co-creator is Tom Wiggin. You may remember him from his 10-year stint playing Kirk Anderson on the soap opera As the World Turns. Songs for Soldiers is his new venture. And Tom joins us from WSHU at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Tom, what's interesting is the amount of stuff you're preloading onto these MP3 players. First of all, describe what they look like and what's on them.
Well, the players are unique in that they are flat, credit card-sized MP3 players and jump drives. You can put not only music on them, but you can put all kinds of files. You can put video files. You can put pictures. You can put documents on them. So we say they're combat ready because they're water resistant, they're shock resistant, they're heat and freeze resistant. You can leave them in extreme conditions, and they're impervious. We discovered these through a business partner, and we were actually at a trade show. And someone pointed out, who was buying for PXs on bases, that this would be a great thing for the troops because they are so impervious. So that got our wheels going, and we started thinking there might be something to that.
And then you also read a study about troops and music, and what'd you find?
John Pieslack, a professor at City University of New York, did a detailed study interviewing service members who emphasized how important music was to their efforts and to their being able to cope with the stress of combat.
Yeah.
Whether it was psyching themselves up the way an athlete would to go play a sport, in this case combat, to execute the rigors of combat, or to decompress from that same combat and to keep them connected to their families and to their home. It had never occurred to us that that was such an important part of the arsenal that they have to help them get through this kind of stressful activity, but it was. And over and over, they kept telling stories about how important music was to them. So we put two and two together and thought, you know, this is one way our company, which sells these MP3 players, could pay it forward. And so that's how this whole thing started.
Well, then what's interesting is what you're preloading these MP3 players with, music written by and performed by troops. Now, this is from the record label To the Fallen Records. We spoke with Sean Gilfillan, a veteran of the first war with Iraq, and here's what he had to say.
Once I got back from Iraq,
I wanted to do something to memorialize some of my friends that died over there. And that's where the logo and the name come from, because, you know, ever since I got out, I wanted to dedicate everything I did, you know, to the fallen.
Tell us about this angle. The troops who get these MP3 players can put whatever they want on these, but you're sending them with music from the troops.
Well, we really liked the name Songs for Soldiers, and we realized we had a wonderful device on which to put those songs. But then it occurred to us, we don't actually have songs. And so if we're going to call this Songs for Soldiers, it might be nice to actually preload these with some songs.
They look down in her eyes and they said with a smile, baby, I ain't going nowhere for a while. Tears filled her eyes, that's a good plan. A huge girl and a sailor man.
Basically, there are probably three major categories of current music: hip-hop, country, and rock. And we did a very quick search and found To the Fallen Records, and they'd done that work for us, because that's exactly what they do. They have three divisions, one for country, one for hip-hop, and one for rock. And they have active duty and veteran service members who are creating this music. So we got in touch with Sean. He was very gracious. He donated his entire catalog to us, and we were off and running.
Well, it becomes a sort of modern-day version of the USO, which, of course, entertained troops for years. And, in fact, you're partnering with the USO. So tell us how it works. You pay it forward. What does that mean? Who pays for it? How do you buy one?
We are hoping that the American public and American businesses will actually provide the funds to donate these MP3 players. We've set it up so that it's pretty easy. It's a tax-deductible donation. It's personalized. And so we're just looking to get as much support as we can, because we're going to do this until we've completed the mission. We don't care whether it takes, you know, a year, 2 years, and we hope these, you know, obviously these conflicts are resolved sometime in the near future so that we won't have to keep doing this.
Tom Wiggin of Songs for Soldiers, working with the USO to get MP3 players to the nearly 185,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll have information on our website, hereandnow.org. Tom, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.